See Rome Vault Podcast, episode number 337. Sunday, May 19th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here. It is just about 7 p.m. on Sunday evening. The final episode of Game of Thrones drops, airs, whatever, in about 2 hours' time. I know some of you are excited, and I know some of you are sick of hearing about it. So, basically, after the coming week, I think the furor will die down, but a lot of people, myself included, have been quite disappointed in this final season of Game of Thrones. It just seems very rushed. But that's not at all the topic of conversation for this episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. Basically, this is... last week, I talked with Eric Boyd, and we talked about several things on a list of topics that he had sent me via email. And one of the things that we didn't get to was so-called new space. Eric will talk about what that phrase means at the beginning of the conversation, but we needed basically a whole second conversation just for that one topic. So we will be talking about current, near future, and in some cases, pretty, you know, speculative long-term ideas about space travel. Nothing outside of our solar system, but still, we do get fairly conjectural at some points in the conversation. I know for some of you, this is a deeply offensive topic. And if that describes you, there really is nothing in this episode for you. So I'd suggest that you go ahead and skip this one. Before we get started, I just edited the conversation and I jotted down a few notes, some things that I was trying to basically pull out of my memory in real time, and things didn't come out quite right. For example, I said that there were 6 biospherians, and in fact, there were 8. And by biospherians, I mean researchers who went inside Biosphere 2 back in 1991 and they locked the doors and tried to survive in there together for 2 years, and basically they were at each other's throats within a year. Not literally, but they they factionalized into 2 groups who didn't really interact much with each other while they were inside and don't talk to each other now, you know, even decades later. Which is, you know, part of the it's a challenge that humans will face if we are looking to do manned missions to someplace further away than our own moon, because just getting to Mars takes several months and could be up to a year of space travel one way, you know, in a tiny little space, a cramped space with several other people, people whose bodily aromas and the sound of their voice and all other manner of things that you generally don't know about most of the people in your life, you know, you will know very well about the people stuck in this can with you. And that level of familiarity, as the saying goes, breeds contempt. So I say there's nothing in this episode for people who are not interested in space, but if you're interested in national security or the current controversy over the United States wanting to create a 5G network but not making the equipment necessary to do so, and the only manufacturers are Chinese companies, specifically Huawei, and the U.S. government, and, you know, not entirely without cause, considers Huawei to basically be an extension of the Chinese Communist Party. When the party says jump, Huawei says how high. So that's what we will talk about first, and then we will segue into talking about new space. So we're going to talk about new space.
Yes, we are.
Before that, right quick, Huawei, they are the only company who make the 5G routers, and the Trump administration and other elements within the U.S. government are saying, danger, danger. What are your thoughts?
I sort of mixed. I mean, I would say that in general, the fear-mongering is slightly overblown, you know, in the sense that, like, we don't have any direct evidence that they're doing nefarious things.
But they have a track record.
Exactly. In another sense, we certainly have grounds to be suspicious. And, you know, sort of in a systems analysis of what China is like, I think you can easily come away with a sense that, like, yeah, suspicion is probably warranted, right? So in that sense, I think it's likely that, you know, you could be spied on, but that's also true for all kinds of stuff. Like, you know, China has similar worries about Cisco equipment in China, right? Like, so in the end, I don't know. I mean, I'm glad I don't have to make that kind of decision. It does seem likely to me that it will delay the rollout of 5G in North America, which just puts North America even further behind the tech curve than we are now. But, you know, that's probably a price worth paying in the end.
From your perspective, what's the value of 5G or 4G?
I mean, sort of the same as the value of 4G was over 3G, right? Like when you get faster, you just enable all kinds of new things. And, you know, it's hard to predict exactly which of those things is going to be the things that deliver super amounts of value. But, you know, we're not going to discover what those are here. They're going to discover them in China instead. Right? Like...
So I talked about this briefly on a video on Friday, which actually didn't get posted till yesterday, but I was in a bad mood for other reasons, and I was just, I let my grumpiness determine the delivery of my thoughts on the 4G situation. Mm-hmm. And it basically comes down to, this is a slow-moving situation. It has taken decades for us to get into this situation where we think we need a particular type of technology that we just don't make.
Yeah. This is the culmination of a very long-term, like, industrial technology policy in China, right?
And the U.S., though.
Yeah, that's true. And the U.S. The U.S. also made, as you say, deliberate choices to, like, outsource manufacturing and outsource design and outsource supply chain and all that stuff. Yeah.
And, you know, even the products that are supposedly, you know, American products, in that they are designed in Silicon Valley or, you know, similar places, they're all made in the same factories that are making those 5G Huawei routers. I mean,
sure,
it's all
yeah.
made in China.
The iPhone being the, like, prototypical example of that.
Yeah. So there are no American electronic products, really.
Yeah, well, there are. I mean, I've worked in industries where, you know, things are still made in North America, but they tend to be extremely high value things. So, like, industrial sensors, right? Like, if you're only going to make it in a volume of a few hundred, and its price is going to be $20,000, it doesn't really matter whether you pay $200 or $400 to have it manufactured. And so, you know, that's still done in North America. But as you say, if you're going to do any kind of consumer product or anything at any kind of volume, everybody just goes to China.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the point that I made in the video was that, look, there are people in the U.S. military, at the Pentagon, in DARPA, whose sole job it is to look ahead and anticipate these sorts of things. And this is a very slow moving process. How is it that this comes as a surprise to anybody?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as you say, if you take a step back and you think systems analysis, obviously this has been coming for a while.
And there are people whose job it is, people who live in nice suburbs in Annapolis. You know, it's their job to think about these things long term and write reports and, you know, make the situation.
Yep. And for all I know, they've been writing those reports. I mean, the funny thing is, when you step back, that's also true of issues like climate change. You know, the U.S. military has been writing really devastating reports about the impact of climate change on them for 20 years, and no one's been paying any attention. So
I remember it was like 2007 or 2008 when the U.S. military was, or not the whole military, just the Navy was doing a big push to convert at least part of their fleet to biofuels. Mm-hmm. And John McCain took them to task and said what a waste it is, because at the time, and it's probably still the case, the biofuels they wanted to switch to were more expensive than bunker fuel.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were thinking well ahead, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You can't wait
until
the price spikes,
like,
to switch over.
Like, this is the thing is, I mean, the reason they were switching is not because, you know, the fuels were expensive. It's because, like, if America goes to war and our supply of crude oil gets cut off, we can't be in a situation where the U.S. military can't fuel its ships. Like, right? So they need to switch to, like, a, you know, domestic supply. And that meant biofuels.
We got plenty of corn.
Exactly. We'll be able to continue to keep growing that, even if, you know, the whole rest of the world shuts us off.
So, final thoughts. 5G, national security, Huawei.
I would just re-echo what I already said. I'm glad I don't have to make those kind of decisions. This is a like an implication of the long-term way that, you know, both Americans and Chinese have been playing this game. I mean, I guess I would, one thing I would say is like the, that kind of like the fear mongering that's happening now isn't great. Like, I think it would be better to actually, you know, step back and seriously think about like, well, what are the actual strategic problems with using equipment that might have Chinese, you know, spying software on it? And there's lots of responses that could include like not, you know, embargoing the purchase of it. Like, for instance, you could just make sure that, you know, traffic is encrypted so that it doesn't matter if it's spied on. Or,
well, presumably,
you know,
important traffic over existing networks is encrypted.
Yes, yes. In fact, much traffic is already, as you say, encrypted. And so we would have to make sure the rest of it is, and then it wouldn't matter whether there's spies. Right. Well, so, I mean, this is one of those, it's an arms race, right? Because, you know, then the Chinese will invest lots of money in, like, you know, crypto breaking spy breakers. And yeah.
Well, on the general topic of the rivalry between the West, so-called, and China, that is, I think, a nice entry into the topic of new space.
Yes, yes. It has been interesting watching China sort of level up its game in the space stuff. I mean, obviously, they're at least 50 years late to that game, but they have been moving up quickly. One thing I would say is that a lot of the Chinese stuff is still highly secretive. Like, you know, it's not the case that we learn about the success of the most recent Chinese mission or failure of it as it's happening. Instead, we get a carefully worded press release from the Chinese government like 3 days later about, like, you know, it didn't actually manage to take off.
Well, they did put a probe on the moon. Was it last year, year before?
Yes, yes. So they landed not just a probe, but a rover on the dark side of the moon, which has now actually been exploring around and supposedly has, they landed it near the polar region. Mm-hmm. And supposedly now it has actually found some water that people speculated would be in that kind of location. So they're doing cool stuff.
Deep crater?
It was actually... Yeah, and interestingly enough, the place they landed is actually, it's inside a deep crater, which itself is inside a deep crater, so it's sort of in like a double shadow zone. And then the other thing that the Chinese started just a couple of years ago is they sort of opened up space to commercial efforts in China. So there's all kinds of new space startups who are, like, you know, focusing on the small sat launch market or other things. And they're experiencing, you know, rashes of weird failures and stuff like that, just like happens in the American scene.
So the general topic that we're going to tackle here is new space. What does that phrase refer to?
I mean, it's sort of a coinage that refers to the fact that a lot of stuff that's happening in space now is commercial efforts as opposed to governments. But it also, I think, refers more generally to the fact that there's a sort of renaissance in activity and interest around activity in space. And so it's everything from super small scale, like CubeSat missions that can be undertaken by student groups, all the way to things like SpaceX, which is, you know, private enterprise that's launching very large rockets for the U.S. military, through to, as I said, things like the you know, new Chinese efforts. And then also things like the Google Lunar X Prize, which had a number of teams competing to be the first private group to land a rover on the moon. There was the Israeli effort that crash landed on the moon just maybe 2 months ago now. So anyway, new space sort of refers to the fact that, like I said, we're having this sort of new renaissance.
Yeah, we talk about AI winters, you know, on the topic of AI. There have been long periods where there was just no enthusiasm outside of the AI community and not much optimism inside it, you know, for long periods. And then, mm-hmm. you know, we come into new phases of enthusiasm. Seems like we've had a space winter, a decades-long space winter.
Yeah. I would say there was a space winter that lasted from the 80s all the way through to the mid 2000s, right? There was 20 years where, NASA was doing the International Space Station in collaboration with its partners, but like nobody was really excited about that. And basically nothing was happening in the private world. And so there was just, you know, all during my childhood, there wasn't really anything interesting going on. But that's no longer true. There's lots of interesting stuff happening now.
On the topic of space winter, I would say there was nothing interesting going on in terms of manned space missions, but robotic missions, particularly to the outer solar system, have been ongoing and really exciting to me.
Yeah, okay, that is true. Yeah, I mean, there was a bunch of, like, you know, Mars rovers and all kinds of things like that, that were great. I would say that like the cadence of those kind of things was a little bit slow, you know, like you'd get one in a good year kind of thing, but they were awesome. I agree.
Well, there's a particular fascination that people have with Mars. And I think Mars missions that are supposed to touch something down on the surface have about a 50% success ratio.
I think it's even lower than that, actually. Yeah, it's embarrassingly low.
But, you know, the stuff that excites me, like the New Horizons mission, which had been sent, you know, it had passed Pluto. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what's next? Billions of Kuiper Belt objects, but, you know, they're tiny and far away. And it's, you know, this thing is basically cruising on its own momentum at this point. It's basically done. And yet with amazing, you know, telescopic work and mind-boggling math, the folks at JPL figured out a way to select a new target for, you know, this probe, which had basically done what it was supposed to do. And they figured out where this, you know, Ultima Thule object was going to be. And they managed to do a close flyby. You know, this was not part of the original mission. Like, to me, that was amazing.
Stunning. Yeah, stunning.
And that's,
I agree.
It's of no interest to the general public. If there's not a human being, you know, setting foot on some new territory, it's just seemingly it doesn't capture the imagination, which to me is a sad, sad commentary on the human imagination, or at least, you know, the popular imagination.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, condemn all of humanity. I mean, I certainly think that you and I are not alone. Like, I started this space club group here in Toronto, just because like I'm certain there's way more people that I could talk to this about. And as it turns out, of course, there are, like, you know, I started it. And basically the idea of space club was like, let's get together and drink beers and shoot the shit about space. Right. And sure enough, now I have over 100 members. And like, you know, when we have a meeting, at least 20 people come and we shoot the shit about space for like 3 hours being like, oh, ah, ah. It's awesome. Yeah.
So how would you describe the psychology of your group? How are they different from the general population?
There's significantly more Russians and former Soviet Union people amongst them than in the general population. Like it's probably half those kind of people, which is well outside of my normal experience, but it is kind of refreshing. Like it's really cool to, you know, hear the other side of it. Like one of the members, Anna, actually, she was telling me stories about how her mother got to go to events in Russia and the Ukraine where they were touring Yuri Gagarin around. Like he would come around and they would have like gigantic things. There'd be 500,000 people there and Yuri Gagarin would give a big amplified speech. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Like, yeah, I didn't really follow.
Yuri Gagarin, for those who don't know.
Oh, he's the first man in space. So it was 1961 or something like that, well before the lunar landings, Russia launched a man into space. He only orbited, I think, a half a dozen times. Like he was up there basically for a day and then he came back down, but first man in space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he actually came back down, unlike, you know, the dog. What was the dog's
name? Yeah, unlike the dog.
So what excites you? I mean, let me get my prejudice out of the way. I mean, I've already sort of hinted at it. To me, space is for robots. I don't think that it makes a whole lot of sense to devote enormous quantities of resources and energy to transport a little bubble of Earth's atmosphere around and shield human beings from all the radiation that, you know, our planet's magnetosphere protects us from and the atmosphere, to make it, you know, to carry a piece of Earth's environment so that we can have humans out in space. It just seems an extravagant use of resources that could be better spent in other ways.
So yeah, I sort of agree. In the sort of new space movement, this is called the like monkeys in, or sorry, canned monkeys issue. Yeah. Yeah. Which is basically like, wow, it's sure hard to get humans to survive in space. And I agree, you know, like for the cost of getting a human to survive in space for a week, you could send like two or three totally kick-ass robots. And, you know, theoretically, I think we're soon on the verge of having robots that'll be more than just like sort of really bad telepresence things, which is sort of what we have now, right? Like there's a little bit of sort of semi, well, not dumb automation that allows the rovers to move around, but generally speaking, every command of those rovers on Mars and all the other robots is thought through in advance by humans and then sent to them and then they do it.
Right.
But I think we're soon going to be at the point where we can have more sophisticated versions of AI that make those robots more capable so that, you know, they're capable of things that really do need, you know, you need to be there in order to do it, right?
Canned apes is, I think, the phrase that I remember from Accelerando, the Charles Stross novel from, I guess, the late 90s.
Yeah, it's a good novel. Yeah. I don't know where I got canned monkeys from, but.
Well, monkey is just a fun word to say. It's an inherently funny word. It's always good to use monkey.
Well, and monkeys are pretty funny, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's also the, I guess, the Fight Club reference to space monkeys, you know, basically disposable things that get shot up into space. They're alive, but we don't care about their well-being.
Yeah. So anyway, I guess I didn't really answer your question about what I think. I mean, I guess what I think is
space monkey.
I think that we should do both. And then hopefully, eventually, both sort of converges, you know, like in the sort of, you know, technological singularitarian idea, we merge with the machines and then there's no difference between the robots and us. That, I think, is a realistic picture of sort of a 100-year time frame of this kind of thing. But in the meantime, you know, that like the reason that human space travel is pursued so avidly, you know, NASA spends half its money on basically the ISS. Even though obviously the returns to that are substantially lower. And the reason they do it is because like that's what keeps the political interest, right? That's what keeps the interest of us non-canned monkeys down here on Earth. And I think that's likely to continue to be true for quite a while, right? I mean, I think, you know, as great as the SpaceX, you know, returnable spacecraft are, I don't think people would be as interested in SpaceX if it wasn't that they also had this mission, you know, where they're going to take humans to Mars. I think people are massively excited about that, even though Mars is going to completely suck for humans, like totally, totally suck. Yeah.
You know, the novel and then the film, The Martian, inspired a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And Andy Weir, the author, you know, he admits, look, I completely had to discount the reality of radiation to make that story work.
Yeah. Yeah, completely and totally.
If you think Mars looked challenging in the movie, that was, you know, a fantasyland vision of what it's actually going to be like, because there are much bigger, more deadly challenges than the ones that the character in that book and film had to face.
Yes, yes. In particular, you can look at the kind of analysis that Mars One has done about, like, what is the allowable radiation exposure for a human, and what does that mean about, you know, our ability to operate on the surface of Mars. And basically, it comes down to the fact that you can't be outside, and by outside I mean like in a giant spacesuit, for more than about 2 hours a day. Otherwise, your lifetime dose exceeds levels that will, you know, double your chance of getting cancer and other problems like that. And the rest of the time, you have to be at least 15 feet underground in some kind of like troglodytic Martian lair, right? Like, yeah.
But like the moon, there are very large lava tubes underneath Mars. I mean, there are ready-made huge caverns that we could build things in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have to actually seal them and then pressurize them. But I agree, you probably don't have to dig them.
Right. Well, yeah. I'm thinking not, you know, the whole thing would be filled with atmosphere, but it's just, there's a, you know, tons and tons of soil and rock, or I guess regolith and rock, between you and the sun.
Right. Right. Yeah. So as long as you're underground, you're fine.
Yeah. You're still living in pressurized habitats. You know, small things with basically, you know, Mars has an atmosphere, but it's so thin that to us, it's basically vacuum. And that's still what's going to be outside your little tent.
Yeah.
Even though you're...
Yeah, it's like 0.4% of our atmosphere or something. Yeah, one of the things actually that Andy Weir says about The Martian is, you know how it opens with that scene of like the sandstorm on Mars blows over the ship, and so they have to like escape? Yeah, that's actually not physically possible. There's not enough atmosphere on Mars to do that. But he needed to have some kind of like accident, right? And I guess that's what he came up with.
It's a story that requires an inciting incident.
Yeah. 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 The other thing actually that Andy Weir cleverly gets around is, for most of the year, like the, you know, Martian winter, Mars has really inhospitable temperatures. So like during the Martian, he was only there 4 months. It was basically the Martian summer. And even the Martian summer is kind of cold. You know, he had that whole scene where he's got to get the RTG, the radioactive thermal generator thing, in order to stay warm in the vehicle. But like even in the summer, it's like zero. In the winter, it's like negative 80 degrees C. And even the RTC wouldn't be enough to keep you warm. Like you have some heating problems. And so the idea, like if you're going to permanently occupy Mars, you have not only this atmospheric problem and this radiation problem, but this temperature problem.
But it still excites people. Does it excite you? Occupying Mars? I mean, you're wearing the Occupy Mars t-shirt.
I am wearing the Occupy Mars t-shirt. I mean, I think, as a sort of techno-optimist, I think that like the challenge of making people live on Mars is kind of exciting in a technical sense, right? But in the end, like, I don't know if I would do it. I also have started this organization called Venus Labs, which is, it promotes the cloud city colonization of the planet Venus. It's super huge amounts of fun. I mean, basically the idea is instead of hanging out in subterranean Martian layers, we should hang out in like stratospheric Venus penthouses. And the big upside there is like there's an area in the Venus atmosphere at about 50 kilometers up where the temperatures and pressures are the most similar to anywhere in the system to what it is here on Earth. And the big downside is, you know, you're living in balloons, you have no access really to the surface. And so sort of our conceptions of how you would live there in terms of like, you know, you're going to mine the ground or whatever to get resources don't really work. We have to completely rethink the way in which sort of the like material existence happens on Venus.
And yeah, you'd think that those habitats would not be made from and supplied by materials from Earth, because getting bulk materials up out of our gravity well is incredibly expensive.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's why like on Mars, there's this idea that, you know, we'd use in situ resources, right? Like we would smelt our own steel from materials we found on Mars. That is not possible on Venus. But there's sort of clever alternatives. So what you have on Venus is basically the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is filled with nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, sulfur, these kinds of things. And it's conceivable to me that basically you could use bioengineering in order to produce the kinds of like films and plastics that you need in order to build the balloons from the Venus atmosphere itself. So it's conceivable that you can still do sort of like in situ resource. It just, you have to think about things in a really different way.
So what inspires the folks who show up to your, hey, let's drink beer and talk about space group?
I mean, I guess sort of the same things that inspire me. Like we just really love like watching technology and how it's happening. And then, you know, speculating about, you know, how awesome it will be to, you know, learn things about space or do things in space or all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's the same, you know, do you watch The Expanse?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the same kind of things that make people want to watch The Expanse, right? Yeah. So there's millions of people like that. And it's just awesome to talk about the possibilities, right? So, I mean, I guess, like, getting back to, like, fundamental human nature kind of things, I really feel like it's the final frontier, right? It's the only frontier left. And so we're excited about exploring it.
On the radio show today, I'm going to be talking to John Adams, who is the director of Biosphere 2. And Biosphere 2, you know, that big glass and steel big greenhouse in the Arizona desert. Initially, its mission was to provide insights onto creating atmospheres and environments on other planets that would sustain human life, and what would we need to take with us to make that happen, you know, with biological systems providing the life support services. And within a year, the six researchers who were locked up inside that thing had divided into two camps, and they bitterly hated one another. And to this day, the members of the two camps don't talk to one another. And they had 3 acres in which to spread out, you know, and create some distance, physical distance between them to sort of keep the peace. On a mission to Mars, you're going to have, you know, 6 or 8 people in a can, basically, for a year.
Yeah. Yeah, and I agree, and of course Mars and the Mars Society, or sorry, NASA and the Mars Society, meeting all kinds of what I would call psychological experiments, precisely where they can find people. Right. In fact, I have a friend who's gone twice now to the Mars Research Station that the Mars Society maintains. It's like a desert outpost where they pretend to be locked in a can for 2 weeks at a time.
Isn't that on the side of a mountain in Hawaii?
No, it's, I don't know, I think it's like in Arizona or something like that. I'm not actually sure.
And at this point, a voice from the future breaks in to say, no, the Mars Society Desert Research Station is in Utah.
But it's definitely not in Hawaii. That would be way more exciting. So it's in, like, they put it in a place where the terrain outside the Mars habitat actually sort of looks a little like Mars, you know. Oh, it's like a bunch of like, you know, dusty scrubland basically. Obviously you wouldn't actually have the scrub plants on Mars, but so yeah, I mean, I agree there's lots of psychological issues, and that's one reason why I think like Venus is a slightly better possibility, because the like on Venus you're going to have these absolutely enormous balloons. Like in order to have enough buoyancy to lift like a small community of say 6 humans, you're going to have a balloon that's like, I don't know, maybe a kilometer across. And so there's going to be the kind of space where, you know, you can totally get away from like far away from someone. whereas, you know, to construct that kind of thing in pressure cylinders on Mars would be incredibly expensive and difficult. And realistically, your best bet would probably be to have like 2 or 3 isolated containers where you get in your spacesuit and then you walk 200 or 300 meters and then you get into a new one, right? But like, it's difficult at best, and you never get to have a sort of open air experience. You know how like to blow off steam, I really love to like go to the local park, right, and just hang out and lay on the grass. That kind of thing is never going to be possible on Mars, or at least not in any kind of short time frame. I mean, ultimately, there's this idea you could build domes, but like that is so far beyond what we're capable of in the near future. It's not realistic to think we'll have it.
Well, I think people who haven't looked into the idea are possibly scratching their head on the idea of living above Venus in a balloon. You know, when you think of a balloon, you think of a balloon popping. But because of the atmospheric pressure at the particular layer that you're talking about, if your balloon was punctured, it would be important to repair it, but it wouldn't be urgent.
Yeah, it comes down to the scale of the thing. Like if the balloon is several hundred meters across and you have a hole that's like a few meters in size, it would take like, you know, 10 years to actually lose enough of the material inside your balloon that you would lose your buoyancy. So you just have, you know, theoretically days to go and make these repairs. Obviously, if something comes along and does like rips a much, much larger hole, you're in trouble. But realistically, if something like that comes along, you're in trouble anyway. Like, yeah. So that is like one of the reasons we called it Venus Labs instead of calling it the Venus Society, was because there are lots of sort of open-ended research projects that need to be engaged in. And one of them is precisely like, is there a sort of pathway that you can follow as you go around Venus that results in you not ever experiencing massive storms, right? And how frequent are massive storms on Venus? We actually know very little about sort of weather on Venus. We know quite a bit about climate, but very little about weather. And so, you know, it's sort of an open-ended question as to whether large balloons would be long-term stable, or whether eventually you would have this kind of like weather crisis that would cause your balloons to be damaged so heavily you couldn't repair them in time.
So what needs to be done to advance the knowledge in that sphere?
I mean, basically, we just need more satellites around Venus that are paying attention to the atmosphere. There's been quite a number of recent satellites around Venus where they've had like radar on board and they've been studying the surface. But there's been less attention on the atmosphere of Venus, and in particular on the regions of the atmosphere that matter to us. This like sort of, you know, in the like third cloud deck kind of rain where the pressure is about 1 atmosphere, temperature is about 20 or 30 C. Yeah, so that's what we need is like, you know, weather satellites basically.
So if the Venus habitat, this balloon habitat, had a balcony that was, you know, open to the environment, you'd need oxygen. You'd need an oxygen mask, but you could survive out there without a spacesuit, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, there is, depending on the way that the cloud decks are moving. So the clouds on Venus are basically formed of sulfuric acid, but it's calling it a cloud is really misleading. It's more like a super light mist, the kind of mist, you know, where you can still see for like a couple kilometers. But that the sulfuric acid, if you're in the cloud, in the mist, that would have like a kind of a tingly effect on your skin. But I agree that in general, you could probably go out there in that with just an oxygen, like a, you know, a rebreather of some sort, and then just put up with the sort of tingliness on your skin for as long as you want. And yeah, you could enjoy yourself on the balcony, hang out in the sun. In fact, there's a really amazing science fiction short story by Jeffrey A. Landis, who's an engineer at NASA. He wrote a thing called Sultan in the Sky, which is basically the story of people who live in these like cloud cities. And he has this whole like unbelievably epic sort of, what do they call it? Like extreme sport, where you put on like a wingsuit and you go out on the with like a little rocket pack too, and you go out on the balcony, and then you sort of jump off and you dive for like, you know, several kilometers cruising down through the Venus atmosphere, and then you ignite your jetpack and return. Which, you know, sounds like you're taking your life in your hands, but it would be awesome.
Yeah, the 25-year-old me would have been all over that, but
yeah,
21-year-old me, not so much. Well, I think colonizing Venus, you know, short of some pretty amazing life extension breakthroughs, is not something you or I are going to see. What are you excited about in the closer term?
In the closer term, I'm really excited to see this, what do they call it, Earth.moon or Moon.earth thing, where SpaceX is going to launch like a Japanese philanthropist billionaire guy and a whole group of artists that he's choosing on a mission to the moon. So I'm excited. I'm hoping that he'll pick like a couple of dancers and we'll get some spectacular zero-G dancing, that he'll pick a couple of poets and we'll get some like poetry talking about and trying to convey the emotional experience of seeing, you know, like kind of the Earthrise photo, mm-hmm. right? Like imagine some epic poetry about that and all kinds of like sort of, you know, artistic stuff around that. I mean, obviously you can imagine paintings as well and stuff like that. So I'm excited for that mission, which should, I think, be sometime in the early 2020s, like, you know, literally like 5 years away kind of time frame. And then I'm also kind of excited by the like Starship thing, right? Where we're going to have like a reusable vehicle that is big enough to perform missions like the one I just described in general. And then, you know, as much as I sort of hate to say it, I am kind of excited by the recent Trump-inspired urgency that NASA has to do the lunar outpost, like just to, you know, finally see us expanding the frontier beyond sort of low Earth orbit for humans in a permanent way, I think is kind of amazing.
So yeah. When John F. Kennedy first introduced the idea of sending a manned mission to the moon, he said, "We do this not because it is easy, but because it is hard." Mm-hmm. And when the Trump administration announced their intentions to reoccupy the moon, science fiction author David Brin started pissing on the idea on his blog, and he said, "We do this not because it is hard, but because it is easy."
Yes.
And I don't think it is easy. I think, you know, kind of like the Martian took place in the Martian summer. Bruce Damer has this rap about how all of these very transitory conditions had to apply at the same time for the Apollo landings to go off as smoothly as they did. And you know, the regolith, or you know, what would be soil here on Earth on the moon, is so abrasive that it's really, really hard on all kinds of equipment, particularly spacesuits.
Yeah.
And that after, you know, a very short time on the surface of the moon, even in their supposedly sealed environment, you know, the astronauts all looked like coal miners. They were covered in this dark, gritty dust that they couldn't do
and
much
it, and
about.
It scratches them up too. I don't know if you've ever been with like volcanic sand. Mm-hmm. It's brutal stuff. And I understand that the moon regolith is kind of similar.
Right. So, I mean, there are serious challenges to long-term occupation of Mars. It's no trivial matter. So,
the moon. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think really, you know, David Brin lives in San Diego, and I think he's basically just got the California mental disease in terms of the Trump administration. Just any excuse to criticize them on any front is too tempting to pass up, even if it makes no sense in terms of their larger worldview.
Yeah. Yeah, so I also read David Brin's blog, and to be totally fair to him, he thinks that the moon is sort of a dead end. Like, there's no resources on the moon that we actually care about, and so, you know, it exists merely as like a staging ground in his mind. But I agree with you that like there's so much to learn that trying to jump straight to either Venus or Mars just seems a little foolhardy. Like, we need a practice ground, and that practice ground could be the moon.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can have a real-time conversation with somebody on the moon.
Yeah. There's only like a second or something of lag. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so we need all kinds of practice about sort of getting more and more laggy. And then just, you know, the moon it's close enough that if something bad happens, it only takes us about a week to get there. Mm-hmm. Whereas, of course, Mars is months away. And yeah. So, yeah, theoretically,
more than a year, depending on where it is in its orbit.
Yeah, exactly. If it's in the wrong part of its orbit, it's
it can be on the other side of the sun from us.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
So, yeah, so the moon, so
we rescue people on the moon, yeah. Theoretically. Yeah,
we've talked about Andy Weir's book and the movie The Martian. Mm-hmm. He wrote a later novel,
Artemis. Yes, I've read it. It's good.
On the moon. And on the moon, I mean, there's a city up there, and their industry basically is aluminum smelting, and a byproduct of that industrial operation is oxygen. Mm-hmm. And you know, his books tend to be fairly scientifically informed, so it you know, at least in his vision, there is some commercially applicable industry that can be set up on the moon.
Yep. Although, I mean, even in the book, basically that industry is rapidly being made obsolete by cheaper production from asteroids. And so they're struggling to find a new business model. But yeah, I definitely think that, like, you know, the in terms of the like in situ resources idea, stuff from the moon, including like raw bulk stuff like aluminum or steel or any kind of
water
or whatever, is going to be perhaps an order of magnitude cheaper than a similar supply from Earth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's an order of magnitude is pretty compelling. Like, I like, you know, spending $1 instead of $10.
Well, for people who don't think about this sort of thing often enough, would you just talk about Earth's gravity well for a bit?
Yeah. So Earth has a gravity that's about 10 meters per second squared, right? Which means when you drop things, they fall very quickly. And the moon is a little less than 2/10 of that. It's something like 17% of that of Earth's. And so when you drop things, they fall much more slowly. And a result of that is it's much easier to launch things off of the moon in terms of like the amount of fuel you require than it is here on Earth. The other advantage of the moon is you don't have to fight the resistance of the atmosphere. The moon has no atmosphere at all. And so as you're going up, your vehicle, you know, your rocket is not being slowed down by air resistance in the same way that, you know, when you drive a car very fast, air is like slowing you down.
Right.
It doesn't happen on the moon. And so like the combination of those two things together, basically, as I said, means that you can get something, you know, into the moon's orbit for about 10% of the price it costs to get something into the Earth's orbit.
10%?
10%.
A dime instead of a dollar.
Yeah. So like I said, that's pretty compelling.
And in the in Artemis, even that advantage is being eroded because it costs nothing, basically, to thrust away from an asteroid.
Yeah, exactly. You get another couple of orders of magnitude, assuming that you can deal with the problem that the asteroids are much further away, and so it takes a lot longer, right? Like, it's going to take a couple of years to get something back from an asteroid. But in space, you know, I mean, everything, you know, sort of moves a bit slower anyway, right? So once things start arriving, it's much cheaper from the asteroids.
When we think of asteroid mining, I think most people, when you say asteroid, the next word that pops into their mind is belt. Mm-hmm. But, and that's a ways away. That's between Mars and Jupiter.
Yeah, it's super far.
Right, but there are near-Earth asteroids that sort of linger in Lagrange points and further away, but in these gravitationally stable positions, that they're much closer.
Yeah, there's much closer things. I mean, in fact, you'll hear in the news every so often about like a near-Earth asteroid that passed, you know, between us and the moon or whatever.
Right.
And the trajectories of these things, a lot of these things, are known well in advance, right? Like, we know where it is and when it's going to be where it is and so on. And so it's entirely conceivable that, like, you could set up, you know, operations on some of these as they get closer, and then sort of as they're getting further away, they're leaving a big chunk of themselves behind so that we can use it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're just mining them the whole time, and when they're close, the transit time is just very short.
Yeah, exactly. So it's mined continuously for the 10 years that it's not close, and then when it is close, it's like sending it all out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, what excites you that we haven't talked about?
Oh, about new space?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question.
We've mentioned Elon Musk a couple times, but Jeff Bezos hasn't come up.
Yeah. So the Jeff Bezos thing, I don't know. I feel like dude needs a better marketing department or something. Because they are doing, you know, interesting things, but somehow they don't get any attention, really. So they've been doing a lot of, like, the sort of the suborbital space tourism stuff. They have a vehicle, the new Glenn, I think it is, that they're doing a lot of hop tests on. They've already done like 11 of them or something. And it has like a capsule at the top that will seat six, and it's going to like launch you up to, you know, 100,000 feet or whatever, and you're going to get a really awesome view of Earth, quote, from space, unquote, meaning not real space in my opinion, but like, you know, it's still high enough that you get to see sort of the, you know, the like blue curvature of the atmosphere and stuff like that. And you'll get to experience, like, you know, not just 30 seconds of zero G as you get in a Vomit comet, but several sustained minutes of zero G. So I think it would be a real experience. And they say that, you know, them and Virgin Galactic, they say that they're going to have those kind of like tickets for that kind of experience on sale, hopefully by the end of this year, but certainly by sometime next year. So that's exciting if you're relatively rich.
Well, they should have a scholarship program for flat earthers.
Yes, yes. Yes, they should. It's like buy one, give one, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, they're working on a much larger reusable orbital rocket that will sort of compete with the, you know, Starship kind of thing that Elon Musk is doing. But again, like I said, their marketing team just doesn't seem nearly as good. And they have the sort of negative association with Jeff Bezos himself, right? This, like, you know, you can afford $1 billion a year to on your rocket program, but you can't pay a living wage for Amazon warehouse employees, kind of like controversy, right?
Well, that brings us up to a common objection, which we should probably touch on, which is that, yeah, this is all sleek and sexy, but really we have serious problems here on Earth that require our attention and our resources. And, you know, looking to space is just a distraction.
Yeah, and I do agree with that in a certain sense. Like, you know, I'm super concerned about climate change, and what do these rockets do? They just burn like absolutely tremendous amounts of fossil fuels, absolutely tremendous. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, if you sort of look at the percentage of the problem that rocketry is, it's tiny. It's way, way less than 1%, right? And so, you know, is it the right move to like cut off all that kind of stuff in order to, you know, prevent that fraction of climate change impact? I don't know. And I mean, I guess what I would say in general is, like, I feel like our civilization can do multiple things and we need to move forward on all fronts. And it's important that humans maintain some level of optimism, right? Like if we all sink into a depression because we're all fighting rear guard actions against nastiness, that's a difficult world to live in. I'd much rather live in a world where, yes, we're actively fighting problems like poverty, problems like climate change, and so on, but also, you know, we're excited about some positive things that humanity is trying to do. So we're not only are we reducing our footprint, as we say, but we're also sort of increasing our handprint, right? Mm-hmm. We're like actively using our hands in order to do things that we find to be incredible and exciting and awesome.
And I don't have exact statistics to, you know, to cite, but the amount that we spend on space exploration is probably equivalent to what we spend on mascara globally. I mean, it's
yeah, yeah, it's tiny. Yeah, I hear that every time, you know, people say like $1 billion is a lot of money. Yeah, there's $3 billion spent in the United States every year on bubble gum.
Right.
Right. So like that puts the NASA budget of about $30 billion into perspective, right? Like,
so ban bubblegum before you come for the rockets.
Yeah, or at least, like, you know, have things in proper perspective, right? Like, yeah, for the amount of excitement and enthusiasm and like scientific value that is delivered, I feel like this space program has been a deal.
Now, this is something I haven't considered before, but, you know, my position is that robots are much better suited, not only for exploration, but also for, you know, the initial stages of manufacturing and colonization and things like that. But they don't excite people's imaginations. But as AI gets more advanced, and AI is advancing faster than robotics, I think.
Yes, it is much faster, in my opinion.
You know, eventually you'll have some AI personalities, like AI celebrities. And if you put a clone of an AI celebrity on your next Mars rover, well, that could well generate enormous excitement.
Yeah, yeah, that's an interesting future, which hadn't even occurred to me, but I agree with you.
Hadn't occurred to me before a minute ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think we're not close to that. Because, like, I mean, there are already sort of examples of what I would call virtual celebrities. There's a couple of them in Japan where they have, like, sort of like a holographic dancer or singer performer person. that is essentially puppeted by a team of controllers. And that's already a sign that as you say, this kind of AI celebrity thing is going to be quite possible. But I think we're quite a ways from it. You know, what you look the few AI robots that we have that have a sort of personality are really quite primitive, right? I'm thinking of the Cynthia Brizel Kismet kind of thing. You know, it's cute, but I wouldn't call it a person in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think that we will start considering our AI companions to be people long before they have any sort of sense of self.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is what humans do, is we project identity onto all kinds of things. You just have to look back at the way that religions used to operate to know that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're approaching the 1 hour mark, which is a really good place to cap these files. Any closing thoughts?
New space is exciting. I just recommend that everybody, get into looking at what's happening, and there's so much interesting stuff. Not that's just happening, but that is planned in the near future. So if you're interested in being inspired, it's a great thing to get into.
Is there a question that you would have me put to the director of Biosphere 2?
The director of who?
Biosphere 2.
Ooh.
I'll be talking to him in a couple hours.
Ooh, that's interesting. I guess my overall question is has substantial progress been made in sealed biospheres since the initial Biosphere 2 experiment? Because one of the things that experiment showed was wow, we do not really have a handle on this sealed biosphere thing. There's all kinds of things going on and we don't understand them. And as far as I know, not much has been spent in terms of on that research in the decades since. And so I'm just wondering does he still feel like we're decades away from sealed biospheres being a workable thing, or are we closer than that?
Okay, I'll ask him. But I do know that Biosphere 2 is no longer even attempt to seal it.
Oh yeah, this is what I'm saying. As far as I know, nobody's been spending money on that kind of science. It hasn't, there hasn't been any money. But that doesn't mean that progress isn't being made, right? It's not like science doesn't advance in other ways. Engineering doesn't advance in other ways. So my question is, if you cobbled together, if you were going to design a new Biosphere 3 or 4 or whatever today, how close do you think it would be to a thing that could stay sealed for a decade?
Well, Eric, it has been fun as always. I look forward to our next conversation.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you, Camo.
That was my friend Eric Boyd. He is somebody I have known since the mid-90s. And as I've said before, we met via the Church of Virus, which was supposedly a memetically engineered religion, but really it was just a bunch of guys and a few gals who got together online to talk about fanciful stuff. All right, well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. As always, thank you very much for subscribing, and I will talk to you again quite soon. Quite soon. I recorded two interviews today, so the other one's going to go up as a Sea Realm podcast, and that will be up tomorrow. That's a conversation with John Adams. He is the deputy director of Biosphere 2. So look for that tomorrow, and then look for another Sea Realm Vault podcast in about a week's time. I don't have anything recorded for that, and I don't even really have anything planned. So if there is any topic that you would like me to go over again, or if there's a new direction you think I should check out, let me know. And I won't repeat the usual information about how to get in touch with me. I think most of you already know. All right. Thanks again. I will talk to you soon. Stay well.